Hold on. Hold your horse. Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, it is February 14th, 2018. We have two bills, really, that we're going to take up today, and we're going to start out with opening the public hearing on Senate Bill 1552, and I'll open that. And Kayla.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1552 does a number of things. It specifies that a public utility that makes sales of electricity may not establish a rate for any service that provides the public utility with a rate of return exceeding 4.5%. It also repeals provisions of the law related to collections of a surcharge for removal of the Klamath River dams upon failure of relevant parties to begin dam removals. It specifies that each public utility commissioner and each employee of the commissioner enter into non-competition agreements with the state under which the commissioner or employee may not be subsequently employed by a public utility that makes sales of electricity for 2 years, among other things that I think Senator Lithicum will probably detail more so than I can, maybe. There is also a Dash 1 amendment that I just received. I have not had the chance to take a detailed look at it, but it addresses the Klamath Fish Habitat Enhancement Fund, and it establishes that in the state treasury. The bill also directs PacifiCorp to credit electric bills of each customer's equal to the total amount paid by the customer as a surcharge plus 4%.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Dennis Lintcombe. I'm the senator for District 28, which includes parts of Jackson, Klamath, Lake, Deschutes, and all of Crook County. So it's a large swath of Central and South Oregon. This is of particular interest to those of us on the California border because of the Klamath River Basin flows from Klamath through California and out to the Pacific Ocean. Along that river, there are several dams that have been determined viable for dam removal, and this has been going on for a couple of decades. So if you don't mind, Senator Beyer, let me reference before I start, I'm familiar with the opinion that you received regarding limiting a public utility to a 4.5 return on a rate of return. And I think the place that I want to continue the conversation is that there has to be some method, some constitutional method for us to limit rates of return on the PUC. So I want to continue discussing this as an option for limiting those rates of return. It can't just be bombs away, no limits involved. We've got to be able to cap it somewhere. So that's my this mainstay of that, because I'm familiar with what you already got a 3 or 4 page opinion last year or 2 years ago. With that, I'm here simply to recommend the 1552 Ratepayer Protection Act. And I'll be the first to admit that the electric grid that we know and, quote, love is reliable, well integrated, and extremely complex. We take this for granted. The grid was designed for efficiency, reliability, safety, most of all, ease of operation, and it is also designed to meet consumer needs at a minimum cost. The grid of the future must also maintain these characteristics as well as account for a whole group of new technologies that we aren't even aware of. But don't mistake my plea here for 1552 and ratepayer protection as just mindless pleading. It is a serious request, and I want this committee to recognize the value of what it would take to limit public utilities from overcharging their customers, aside from the CUB, which you're familiar with. So all of these things are intricate players. Currently, the PUC schedules include rates to encourage acquisition and cost-effective conservation resources. They include rates for encouraging tree planting. They include rates for income taxes paid by the utilities. They also include compliance with greenhouse gas emission standards. All of these things are encompassed in rates. What that essentially means is these rates are on the backs of taxpayers or ratepayers within that district franchise boundary. So this, you've heard this saying before, and I know you're familiar, and I hope this causes a little bit of a smile. You guys look so serious today. Give an inch and they'll take a mile, and only this time it's coming from the public utilities. A nearly 8% rate of return on their infrastructure and investment is just hammering the single ratepayer who's out there on the street. Ratepayers are bearing this burden. The backbone of our economy is already wary of corporate taxes, individual income taxes, possibility of a new carbon tax, annual permit fees, licensing requirements, gasoline tax increases, property tax assessments, vehicle registration fees. I could go on and on. All of these are taxes and fees and permits and burdens that are on the ratepayer that is in these district boundaries. No one's denying that. What we need is to think deeply about, I'm sure you saw Senator Johnson's, it was a recent blast coming out of Tobias Reed's office, where they're talking about the great opportunities for debt servicing and the economy's looking good. Senator Johnson says, however, caution is required. While Oregon's Oregon's economy appears to be robust, recent volatility in the stock market sends us a cautionary note. So all of these things, I'll point out some details about the importance of that cautionary note. Using 2850 as a recent high for the S&P 500, there was a $110 per share growth rate since 2007. That growth rate was 2.4% on an average basis. So if you were fully invested in the standard in S&P 500, averaged over the decade, you would have a 2.4% increase on an annual basis. We're paying the public utilities for their infrastructure improvements nearly 8%. And for the taxpayer to pay them 8% while only earning 2.4 out the backside is just an imbalance that Oregon taxpayers are being saddled with. And so wage rates are lower than the 8% per annum. Right? We all know this. The only other party that's making 7.75 are PERS Tier 1 employees. Everybody else is out there in the marketplace trying to make ends meet. So what the consumer has done, and you are also aware of this from an economic standpoint, is the consumer, to combat their flatlining in the economy, the average man and woman on the street, the households, the farmers, the small business users, the boutique manufacturers, who are all using this precious resource called electricity, those individuals have turned and looked for debt to sponsor the lifestyle that they become accustomed to. Let me give you some numbers. $13.6 trillion in mortgage debt, $1 trillion in total credit card debt, $1 trillion in auto loan debt, $1.3 trillion in student loans, $300 billion in credit card debt. Now, the only reason I'm referring to this when we're here today talking about limiting ratepayer harm from public utilities is because it's all got to come from the discretionary income of the ratepayer taxpayer. If we don't pay attention to the harm that we're actually doing to the taxpayer as we burden them with these fees, permits, charges, and rates, then we as Oregon economy will be between a rock and a hard spot. So that's a summary there from an economic perspective. It's extremely important to keep the healthy economy at our fingertips, and we can best do that by limiting the amount of money that gets sucked off to the utilities. Let me just summarize for you. The Legislative Fiscal Office gave me some power rates on the ROR rates. Remember, I'm asking for 4.5. Idaho Power, 7.75. Pacific Core, 7.65. It was reduced recently in January 2014 to 7.62. PG&E is 8.03 from 2010, then reduced in 14, 15, 16, and again here in 18. It is now at 7.35. These are all tremendously more than that average 10-year 2.4 that I referred to earlier. There's one other point, aside from trying to limit all of these aspects of the burden we're placing on ratepayers, there's one other aspect of the bill that will be most unusual, and that's Section 8 of the bill, which would stop the collection of the Klamath Dam removal surcharges from utility bills of ratepayers within that district. So for nearly two decades, factions have struggled with regard to the Klamath Dams and with fish habitat and fisheries and river flow and flood and reservoir. All of these issues are out there. You are probably well aware of them. It's about time, after 20 years, we simply said, for good or bad, the Klamath Dam removal is not going to happen. The issues are too big and too large for us to solve with a wrecking ball. What I would suggest in the Dash 1 amendment that Ms. Byers referred to is a Dash 1 amendment that would utilize the money instead of refunding it to the ratepayer, which I hope I've made a case for, they could sorely use it. Instead of that, use it for fish ladders, fish mitigation efforts, and salmon habitat, and clean that up so the dams actually become productive assets on the Klamath River. So if you have questions, I'll be happy to answer them, and I won't take any more of your time because I know you guys want to get out and go golfing.
Some of us are here till 7:30 tonight. The committee hearings, Senator Drew.
First of all, I hate golf, but one thing, and this is just a comment. I think that there is a real thing to be learned about what happened down on the Klamath and the importance of fish numbers. I have declining fish numbers in my district. Winter steelhead have plummeted, and we could be facing the same sort of situation. And so I do believe that we need to kind of have some catastrophic plans when some of these things happen so that the average individual just doesn't get hammered. And I do feel that what's happened down in the Klamath is one of the saddest things that I've ever seen.
Others? Senator?
Yeah, Senator Lithicum, I noticed your use of dates was interesting, starting in 2007 for the next 10 years. If you start in 2009, it would be a different number, because we know the stock market went to a tailspin from 7 to 9 and then gradually climbed back out. So, I studied statistics when I was going to college, and we used to have a saying that there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. I'm not saying this was a damn lie, but you did make a curious use of when your starting date was.
May I respond?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. The 2008 is when the agreement in principle was signed with regard to dam removal. Yeah. So 2008, whether you pick here. 7 or 8, you're still at the bottom of the hole.
Yeah.
And 7 and 8 is when the dam agreement, remember, in the Klamath Basin, it started from the drought in 01, the Bucket Brigade and all that. So it took nearly 8 years to come to an agreement in principle. The agreement in principle in 08 is where this agenda was crafted. The agreement in principle had four distinct parts. First was to study the dams and weigh the with science and environmental data and weigh the cost and the benefit. And after doing that, you could identify a DRE or a dam removal entity, and the dam removal would then decide how to march forward with that task. Or, and this is the or clause that I want to put my finger on, the Pacific Corps in that area, and remember we're talking statewide for utilities, but Pacific Corps in the dam removal arena could decide to keep the dams and mitigate the fish with fish passage ladders and bring that population back into control by using money to accomplish that. That money's been sitting in a bank account or trust fund all these years. Yep. I think the Dash 1 amendment lends itself for using that money wisely without detonating the big stick.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I have two other people who have signed up, Glenn Spain. Welcome, sir.
Senator Lincoln is a hard act to follow, but I'll do my best. My name is Glenn Spain. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the largest trade association of commercial fishing families in the West Coast, many of them in the coastal area here. We are a party to the Klamath Hydropower Settlement Agreement, that is the written agreement between Pacific Corps, the two state governments, and various federal governments. And multiple stakeholders, including ourselves, including the four major tribes in the Klamath, to ultimately remove the Klamath dams. Mr. Linthicum's Section 8 is troubling in a number of ways. One is that it's based on two fundamentally wrong premises. One, and this is also what he stated in his newsletters and such, is that the agreements are dead. They're by no means dead. They were, the Klamath Hydropower Settlement Agreement did not expire on its own terms without congressional authorization. It was amended in April of 2016. And rather than going through the congressional process, it's going now through the FERC process, which is the traditional process since 1920 that all dams that are licensed by FERC go through in terms of any modifications and or removals. The company wants the dams down. It is their business decision, and there are very good reasons for it. And that's the other fundamental premise, that the deal is a bad deal. It is, in fact, a very good deal for customers. I also represent a lot of fishermen in the coastal areas that are Pacific Corps customers. And they're happy to pay the $2.38 on their surcharge to remove the dams because those dams block our major fish runs, which also influence the central coast of Oregon. We harvest most of our fish in Oregon from fish that are in origin from California, and many of them from the Klamath. The declines in the Klamath runs have affected our economies in the coast. So these are economic benefits in terms of dam removal. But more important than that is that the dams themselves are obsolete. They're not cost effective. Trying to keep them would cost 2 to 3 times more than removal and replacement of that power through other means. Keep in mind that these dams were constructed starting in 1918. A lot has changed in 100 years. The original purpose of the dams was simply to provide some power for Klamath Falls. Well, today, there's a 6-state grid. Pacific Corps has 600,000 customers in this state alone. power in your light bulbs here come from anywhere in those six states. Any place that can generate power can be moved from place to place. It's no longer cost effective to keep these small, non-productive dams in place, and that was the company's decision. I'll give you some numbers, and this is in my testimony, reference to FERC data, reference to PUC data, and reference to sworn testimony of the Pacific Corps. The KHSA, we call it, it's an acronym-rich business in my line of work, but the Klamath Hydro Power Settlement Agreement caps the customer obligation at $200 million. And that was to be collected over 10 years. We're 8 years into that collection process, and it's still going on with a valid agreement under PUC trusteeship. If they were relicensed, and there is only two options, they can't remain the same because the license expired in 2006. They must be either relicensed to current modern standards or taken down, one or the other. To relicense them would cost between $460 and $500 million. And FERC's own estimate from their documents, and I've cited it if you want to look it up, the dams would then run at a $20 million a year loss. PacifiCorps, in its judgment, concluded, and this wasn't an environmental issue, these were accountants that did this, concluded that their money is better used elsewhere for more modern plants. One modern power plant can generate on the order of 1,000 megawatts. These dams all combined generated 82 megawatts, and that's all over the last 50 years, according to FERC records. So they're small. And it doesn't make any sense to take two small dams, pay 500 to more, there's no cap on that, 500 more ratepayer dollars, a million more, to generate so little power. It would be some of the most expensive, least viable power in the West Coast. So that was the equation. And what this does, unfortunately, is it doesn't recognize the fact that A, the KHSA is alive and well, and B, it's a darn good deal for customers like my people and like a lot of people in this room. There will be no other additional rate increase. That's already been paid, prepaid in the trust fund. But if they have to go through the lot relicensing, it would be prohibitively expensive. And that's the essence of it. Keep in mind that it doesn't make a lot of sense to keep failing assets. On the time frame that dams go, we think of them as sort of forever, but in fact they're constructed, artificially constructed. They have a lifespan. They're for particular purposes, and they can become obsolete. It would be the equivalent of taking your Edsel Ford and trying to re-engineer it, buying and machine hand-making each and every replacement part in something that you could probably replace much cheaper with a new Mercedes. And that's essentially what we're dealing with here in this Section 8. It's pointless. It's based on false premises. And if it were enacted, it would not stop dam removal. This dam still would not make economic sense to keep. But what it would do is double or triple, maybe even more, the rate shock to 600,000 customers in this state. They would all, you know, the way utilities work is the only source of income is their product. That's how they make their living. And so any costs, additional costs through relicensing or what, have to be allocated to the rates. And the unintended consequences of this section would be quite large on a whole lot of people. So it doesn't make really a lot of sense to pass a legislative measure like this that micromanages a decision by the company in its best interest, in the interest of its ratepayers, that has been approved by the PUCs as literally, quote, in the best interest of customer ratepayers. So it doesn't make a lot of sense from a business perspective for us here to be micromanaging that decision. Any questions?
Senator Monroe and then Senator Girard.
Yeah, before the dams were built 100 years ago, the Klamath was one of the biggest fishing streams on the whole West Coast. And now I've seen the pictures. the dams cause the water to be too warm and you have huge die-off, and salmon runs are not nearly what they once were. Has there been any estimate done in terms of what, if the dams are removed, what would happen to the salmon runs, the fish runs? I'm a yeah. fish advocate. And I wondered if to some degree, we could expect those fish runs to come back if we remove those dams.
In fact, they would more than double. Originally, the Klamath runs were the third largest salmon runs in the continental U.S. Now they're at a fraction, like 4% of that. Yeah. Some of them are endangered, as listed, federally listed endangered species. This year, we are closed down, as you probably are aware, in much of the Oregon coast and most of Northern California because of the Klamath. That's because water quality is so poor there, and the toxic algae that accumulates in these slack water reservoirs is so toxic that many, many of the fish die before they even enter the ocean as juveniles. There are rampant diseases that are perpetuated by these conditions. These are clean water quality issues. These dams do not meet modern clean water standards, period. That's one reason it would be expensive to retrofit them. Taking them down is estimated to at least double the size of the runs back toward original historic numbers. And what that means is a lot more jobs and a lot more flexibility in management because, as you know, I hope, we're in a weak stock management regime in the ocean.
Yep.
When we have one weak stock and it intermingles, we're off the water. Even though there may be thousands of millions of fish out there, we're off the water. That's what happened this year. And it's primarily because of the damage done to the river by the Klamath dams. So here you have non-productive assets that would cost far more to keep than to take down, and also promote a real environmental disaster there that is also an economic drain on the coastal and fishing economies, is in violation of treaty obligations as well. And there is no rationale to keep them. The Pacific Corps, by the way, in terms of replacing that small amount of power, 42 megawatts, has already done it 17 times over since the deal was signed. They were under obligation when Pacific Corps was purchased by Berkshire Hathaway, by RPUCs, to bring online 1,400 megawatts of renewable, non-polluting energy. And they've done that and exceeded that. So replacing the power is a non-argument. They've already done it 17 times over.
Senator Girard.
Well, this is a kind of a, it really is a very tough situation down there, and I've followed it fairly closely. We do have treaty obligations, but I have to tell you that sometimes some of that bothers me because we still gill net on the Klamath, and I really feel that that is a major contributor to the problem. And so I would, you know, if I had, I was all powerful, I would really try to do everything I could to get the tribes to back off of and use alternative methods. But I don't think the loss of the dam and the power is really the thing that's really driving the equation down there with the farmers. I think it's the loss of water storage, and that's the hard thing. I mean, you're costing a lot of people the whole total value of their agriculture, so, or their farmland. So I was kind of hoping that they would be able to find some solutions other than dam removal, but I understand why they ended up that way.
From my answer to your question, keep in mind that the irrigation community, they're pretty much unanimously supported dam removal. They signed on. And the dams are below the irrigation project. They have no impact on irrigation at all. They're also not storage dams. They don't store water. They're run-of-the-river dams. There's no flood control benefit to them. They don't affect irrigation at all. And in the overall deal, the irrigation community up there would get a lot of benefits, including a guaranteed water supply. That part of it unfortunately died for lack of congressional authorization. There's a bunch of stuff there that needed congressional approval. The dam removal does not. The dams are there. Their license is expired. The company is on the stick. They have to do one or the other, either remove them or relicense. If relicensing costs three times the cost of removal, pretty clear.
But I have You're looking at somebody that has a district. We have a lot of dams in my district. And, you know, the thought of trying to remove Detroit Dam or Big Cliff or some of these other dams that actually the water that you drink, if you drank water here in Salem, we're dependent on.
Well, let me emphasize that our position has always been no dam is like any other dam. They're all, none are created equal. Mm-hmm. They all are individual constructions. Mm-hmm. For certain engineered purposes with an engineered lifetime. You have to look at each situation separately. Mm-hmm. And in this case, these dams, over 100 years old, are too expensive to fix up. That's basically what it amounts to.
Other questions?
And I sympathize on the issues of water. There are still efforts on board. I'm one of the negotiators to try to come to a better settlement on the water issues up there. And it's tough.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Doug McCourt.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Doug McCourt. I'm legal counsel for the Klamath Tribes of Oregon, and I am here today to do two things. One is to read a very brief statement we've submitted in testimony from the Klamath Tribes, and then answer any questions you might have, including digging deeper into the ones that have already been asked. Let me just say before I start that we support the entire testimony from Mr. Spahn, and I can tell you we're way beyond fish grains here. you know, it's not going to solve the problem that exists from those dams and removing the dams. But let me proceed with this brief statement, and then if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. The Klamath Tribes oppose Senate Bill 1552. The Klamath Tribes, a federally recognized Native American nation, consists of three Native American tribes who traditionally inhabited southern Oregon and northern California, the Klamath, Modoc, and Yahuskan Band of Snake Indians. The tribe's headquarters are located in Chiloquin, Oregon, in the heart of the Upper Klamath River Basin. The tribe's 1864 treaty with the United States reserved hunting, fishing, trapping, and gathering rights for the tribes and its members. The Klamath Tribes oppose Section 8 of the bill concerning funds for Klamath Dam removal. The bill would abolish the existing trust fund that was created to fund that removal, and dam removal is supported by a wide coalition of interests in Oregon and California, including owners and operators of the dams, as you've heard previously. Those owners who hold the licenses for the dams are currently seeking permission from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to transfer and ultimately terminate the licenses in order for dam removal to proceed. As you probably know, dam removal is scheduled to commence in 2020, which makes the timeline set forth in Senate Bill 1552 impossible on its face to meet. Eliminating the trust fund to remove the dams is directly contrary to the wishes of many Klamath Basin stakeholders and would thwart years of careful planning and consensus building around their removal. More importantly for the Klamath Tribes, the dams destroyed their salmon habitat and salmon runs that were reserved under the tribe's treaty with the United States in 1864. The trust funds for dam removal are critical to restoring treaty resources of the Klamath Tribes. Removing the funds that are necessary for dam removal will also impact commercial and recreational fishing and the interest of the public in the Klamath River's resources across two states. For those reasons, we urge the committee to reject this bill. One thing I can tell you, Senator Girard, is that the Klamath Tribes of Oregon do not gill net. They don't gill net on the Klamath River because those runs were destroyed 100 years ago by these dams. Now, they're fighting with everything they can to preserve the imperiled, endangered sucker species in Upper Klamath Lake, as you might be aware. And that's what they have left. But there are generations alive today who remember from their ancestors when they had salmon. And because those are treaty resources, they have a special relationship to those and with the United States government and with the state of Oregon. So this is a very critical problem, one that has received not unanimous, no problem gets unanimous support, at least it's very unlikely, but you know, when the owners themselves have made the decision to remove these, for the reasons you heard very eloquently prior to my testimony, you know, my experience, I practiced energy law for over 30 years here in the state of Oregon and on a national level. I can tell you that these are not assets worth preserving. And the problems will remain as long as those dams remain. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator?
Trust me, I sympathize, and I am very pro-fish. I think Senator Monroe down there will tell you how pro-fish I am. And I want to get the numbers up, but I do think that the Native Americans down in that area, the tribes that you represent, if we could just have a few years where they would just not fish, would really help get the numbers back up. I know they have a treaty right to be able to do that. But don't get me wrong, I'm not necessarily opposed to the removal of the dams. I do have a problem with the irrigation and how it's impacted people and the farmers up through there. I'm really saddened by that. And I have a district that, trust me, we have problems with fish numbers as well. And I like to fish, but I do know that there's going to come a point, and I'm sure that it is up where I'm at, where I can't win or steal that fish, or it has to be catch and release, and et cetera. So I would encourage you, that's just me, to just maybe take a fraction of what you normally take or just reduce the numbers. And I know you have a treaty right, and I appreciate the treaty, and trust me, that's one of the hardest things I've ever said, because in history, I know the history of the Native Americans and how just about every treaty that they ever made has been broken. I'm just saying voluntarily, I think that that would be a nice thing to try to get the fish numbers up. Even before all the dam removal, I just think that that's imperative down there.
If I may, a brief response. I appreciate that comment, Senator Girard. And when years ago, maybe 10 years into my practice, there was an organization started called the Coalition of Large Tribes, and then another similar organization around tribes that had energy interests across the U.S., including hydroelectric interests. And the executive director of that organization said, when you've met one tribe, you've met one tribe. Mm-hmm. And what that really means here is the Hoopa, Yurok, and Karuk tribes in Northern California that are dealing with the salmon populations on the lower Klamath River have a similar problem with declining populations, but they are affected by those dams in a different way, and that's their history, their culture, including gill netting, is very different from the Klamath tribes, even though they may be considered cousins in a sense going back historically. And so the practices, I can assure you, of the Klamath tribes of Oregon are different, although I think one of the most instructive things to read on this is the U.S. District Court opinions that ordered the Klamath project from the Bureau of Reclamation in late 2017 to release a significant amount of water out of the Upper Klamath Lake to protect fish flows for these species we're talking about here. And I can tell you, going into a drought year this year, it's going to be a real challenge to manage Upper Klamath Lake and deliver that amount of water, protect the levels necessary for these endangered species in Upper Klamath Lake, and then meet the irrigators' demands. But I would point to the fact that the Klamath tribes of Oregon have always tried to find a way to work with the irrigation community, and that's why in 2015 they supported Senate Bill 206, which allowed this flexible transfer situation of irrigation claims throughout the basin. And they're continuing to try every way to work with the irrigation community. But the issues that are facing the lower Klamath River tribes, with the decline in populations that are explained in this district court opinion, are very severe, and the numbers have plummeted, and down to levels when if we have a severe drought year, if that trend continues over the next several years, we may get to a point in the populations where they're simply below levels that can be sustained and brought back. And that's what we're facing in Upper Klamath Lake now. They're facing that with the salmon in the lower Klamath. So, again, we would urge the committee to not to to reject the Senate bill, but I will clarify, we are here testifying really just with Section 8 of Senate Bill 1552.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close public hearing on that. And colleagues, as we noted, as Senator noted earlier, we have a little constitutional issue that Legislative Council's put up. Posted on the legislative website, so we will not be moving that bill today. And essentially that means we will not be moving that bill or acting on it during this legislative session. So we'll move on now, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1519.
A public hearing, sir, or a work session?
Oh, I can do a work session.
Yeah.
We'll open a work session. I was going to give a chance for anybody who wished to comment on the dash one, since they didn't have a chance to see them before the last public hearing. If somebody wanted to comment on those, I would be willing to allow them to.
Mr. Chair, the dash one amendments were available prior to the last public hearing, I believe.
Oh, I didn't think they were.
They weren't for the first public hearing.
Oh, excuse me. I didn't think they were up until recently. So people had a chance to see them.
Yes, sir.
Well, there you go. I was wrong. good enough. So
are we going to move
Before we do that, I would like to ask Tim Walker to come up. We've gotten the fiscal impact, and I need some clarity on that.
Yes, me too.
Thanks, Tim. Tim, I was looking at this, and I'm a little confused. I've been working through the interim with Senator Olson and with Representative Hovey, and we thought we had introduced the same bill essentially on both sides. A few changes on the Senate side. We lowered the ESA cap, although we didn't, it's still quite a bit above what the current funding level is, or in the highest level it's ever been. And we thought we reduced the staffing requirements on the two. We both created approximately the same size of oversight council. Under the House bill, it's an advisory council. And on the Senate bill, it's more of a commission like the other ones. I noticed in the two reports on the House side, the cost is about a third of what it is in the Senate bill. And I'm trying to understand why one is more expensive than the other. In fact, I'm kind of trying to understand why, when you're reducing the scope of the department, why the costs go up rather than down.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I don't have the House bill in front of me, but I think the major change that we see is the transferring of the various loan programs to Business Oregon. As far as a support of the commission or the board that's going to be working with the Department of Energy, there is probably some changes in there. I will say, though, that the important thing is it's got the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, where we can have a rich and full discussion about these issues.
I'd like to have those discussions here. That's always a bone of contention between the policy committees and Ways and Means.
That's why we're there.
I'm on both.
Well, that's why you're here. So that we can understand. So if we're going to send something down, we know what the impact is.
Well, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I would recommend that you bring up the Department of Energy and Business Oregon to have that discussion with them, because that would be essentially the same discussion we will have in Ways and Means. Their budget analyst will have those conversations along with Ken and the co-chairs. I can't speak in depth to, and I know to essentially what the fiscals say, but I think you'd be better served by having Energy and Business Oregon speak to the fiscal itself.
All right. Well, we'll have them join you then. Okay. If we have the director in the audience. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Janine Benner. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Energy, and I'll introduce my colleague, Blake Johnson. He's our Chief Operating Officer.
Okay. So explain what the difference is.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Thompson. The two bills, as we see it, are quite different. The House bill is 7 pages long. The Senate bill is 88 pages long. And the board and commissions that are envisioned by the two bills are very different in terms of their duties and their functions.
How so? Now, let's be clear. Most of the 88 pages are conforming amendments. The actual, the context of the two bills are almost identical.
Most of the 88 pages, as I read
about,
it, are replacing.
I think it's about 6 pages in the Senate bill that actually has any change.
Senator Beyer, yes, that's true, conforming amendments, but the conforming amendments replace any place Department of Energy is mentioned in statute with the Oregon Energy Commission. And I think that's representative of what the commission does in this bill, which is take the duties and responsibilities with respect to rulemaking and policy setting and personnel and everything of the director in the State Department of Energy and give it to the Oregon Energy Commission.
So why does that increase costs? Because I would assume that that's all staff work, and the only difference is who approves it. Rather than you approving it, you would be making a recommendation to the commission, which would then approve it.
Senator Beyer, yes, that's one way that it could be done. But if you look at the legislation, I would refer you to page 3, section 5, functions general authority to adopt rules. It is the function of the Oregon Energy Commission to establish the policies for the operation of the State Department of Energy. The commission shall adopt rules and issue orders as necessary for the administration of the laws of the commission. The commission shall cause a public hearing to be held on any rule or standard prior to its adoption. There's a lot of substantial, I could go on, there's a lot of substantial work envisioned for this commission that will need to be done in numerous meetings and staffed by, we envision two additional staff.
I hear you, Director, but I would take the, on the analysis of the, on HB 4148, it says the Oregon Energy Board shall develop a statewide strategic energy plan and advise and make recommendations to the department on policies, administrative rules, planning, technical analysis, legislative concepts, and the department's agency's budget. That seems to me doing exactly the same thing. It's just the difference of who, in the end, signs the order.
Senator Beyer, I appreciate that perspective. We see it a little bit differently. We did envision an additional FTE to enable us to staff that Oregon Energy Board. This is not in the 4148, that board would meet 4 times a year. We envision the commission meeting much more frequently than that in order to accomplish all of the duties as directed in the bill. In addition, the Senate bill changes statute and the general duties of the department in a way that I think will mean that we need additional staff to work with the commission to be able to figure out how to implement that. There's another few cost drivers in the Senate bill that are not present in the House bill. For example, the Senate bill envisions an energy plan, the development of an energy plan, and we have recommended two additional staff to help us do that.
According to this, the House bill says the energy board will develop a statewide strategic energy plan.
Yes, Senator Beyer, that is a duty assigned to the board, supported by the department, and that will be done.
So how is that different than the strategic plan that the Senate bill envisioned?
So I can refer, Senator,
I mean, having talked with Senator Hovey and worked with him for almost 3 years on this, I think we are of a common mind of what we think we were looking for. We were looking for a strategic plan that would have some relationship to the annual analysis and reports that are done, so I don't see that as significantly different in terms of the duties assigned.
Well, Senator, in the House bill, Section 5, there's a one line, shall develop a strategic energy plan for implementing the energy policies. The Senate bill spends a couple pages discussing what is going to be in that plan in a way that I think adds some.
So you're assuming the House plan would be much more lightweight than the Senate plan was envisioning?
I don't, Senator, thank you for the question. I don't envision a lightweight plan, no, sir. But there are some, you know, to be frank, we had to make some assumptions about how we would develop the plan in the Senate bill because we're not, there are some, I'm not entirely sure how we would implement it, but it talks a lot about cost effectiveness and cost drivers. We don't currently have an economist on staff who we could dedicate to this work, so having an economist at least come on short time.
So you wouldn't intend to do that kind of work under the House plan, look at cost effectiveness?
I think under the House plan, we could do this mostly with existing staff.
Well, I hope you're looking at it a little more seriously than that. One of the big concerns during the interim committee hearings, and you weren't there, so I'm not pointing it at you, Janine, is we didn't think that we were getting that kind of information, which we thought was very vital. And I hope that we're not going down the road of doing some changes and ending up in the same position where we're not getting the information that the legislature thinks is necessary. Mm-hmm. So I have a concern about that. If that's the effect of we're getting a low-cost plan as opposed to one that meets our needs.
Senator, I appreciate that concern. I think some changes that were made in the last legislative session with respect to the legislature last session changed the existing biennial energy plan into a biennial energy report and outlined ways in which we were going to be able to present the information that you are interested in, and we've put a lot of staff time and effort into developing that biennial energy report. Those staff are working on that. This would be an additional responsibility on top of that, and I'm, you know, I hear what you're saying, and I share your concern and would like to make sure that whatever plan we do is robust. I'm just looking at the two bills. There are significant differences. A third
So if we just changed the Senate bill, I'm curious, if we took the authority to adopt administrative rules and just made that body an advisory body, would that reduce two-thirds of the cost?
Senator, with respect to the cost of staffing the board or commission, I think we would see significant reduction if the commission were made to look more like the House bill. There are additional cost drivers in the Senate bill. There's a study on restructuring that we would want to bring in an expert on agency structure to look at. You and your colleagues spent a year looking at the structure of the department. It took 25 hours. You did a lot of work, and if we're not going to just sort of rehash what we talked about with them, we'll really want to bring in somebody to accomplish what it is that you all would like to do with the Department of Energy to make it a healthy agency.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. All right. I would entertain a motion to adopt the -1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the -1 amendments.
Is there any discussion on that motion? Is there any opposition to that motion? The -1s are adopted. I would entertain a motion to move the bill with a do pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means as amended.
Good question.
Yes.
Do you want to further amend it to get the cost down?
No. Okay. We'll send it to Ways and Means.
All right. Let them worry about it.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1519 with the -1 amendment with a two-pass recommendation.
With the subsequent Ways and Means.
Subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Thompson has moved Senate Bill 1519 as amended by the -1s. With a do-pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, it's passed. And we close on that. And I will just note for the record, we will not be considering Senate Bill 1564, which is the distilleries bill that we talked about, that obviously needs more work. And what we're going to do is we're going to work on creating a joint House and Senate work group over the interim to take a look at that and see if there's a way that we can constitutionally help out the small distillers. Anything else for the good of the order? If not, we're adjourned.